The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Are you ready for more independence as a financial advisor? Consider the RIA model. Schwab Advisor Services has helped thousands of advisors make the move. To find your path, start with Schwab at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths today.
Coming up on this week's show, a rare Atari prototype is now playable.
How to build your own CRT portable console.
And we speak Sega, Simpsons, and Ghostbusters with John Melcher.
Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, their latest book, you need to check out, The King of Fighters, The Ultimate History, detailing one of the most important fighting game series of all time and officially endorsed and with the help of SNK. So if you want to check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books, you'll find it right now at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay, who offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast-turnaround quality boards, and they do features such as 3D printing and injection molding, and they're massive supporters of the retro community. Get an instant quote right now for your project at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 330, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Robbie Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And welcome to our favourite time of the week, just before the weekend, a brand new episode of the show every Friday, where we take you on a journey inside the world of retro gaming, bring you up to speed on all the stories that you need to know about from over the last 7 days. And of course, the main reason that we do this show is to get the stories from the people who made the games themselves back in the day. And my word, have we got an incredible guest this week. Now, guest this week, actually, John Melcher, he's worked on not only some of the biggest video game franchises, but entertainment franchises, stuff like The Simpsons, Ghostbusters, and lots more as well.
Yeah, man, this was such a good interview. He's done so much over the years, and he actually started at Sega of America in the early 90s as a quality assurance tester, a QA tester, which I love because we've had quite a few people now who have kind of started in that kind of QA role, and then they kind of learn how to make the games or, you know, learn about the industry. And he kind of went into an assistant, you know, producer role, and then he moved on to a producer's role and then became like an executive producer. And he worked on so many games, and Ravi has done such a good job of getting a hold of him because you've been speaking to him on and off for a couple of years now. And, you know, he's been really like, oh, I'm really too busy kind of thing. But he's always been great at like replying and saying, you know, what about next month? What about this month? And we finally locked him down. And, you know, some people might be thinking, oh, God, this interview is not that retro because, you know, it's kind of half the early days with him at Sega and EA. And then we kind of speak a lot about, you know, Simpsons Road Rage and Simpsons Hit and Run. And I couldn't resist because they are some of my favorite games, part of one of my favorite franchises. And, you know, those are the games I grew up with. So I really kind of had to go for it with this one. And, you know, Ravi was asking him all about Ghostbusters and stuff, you know, which once again, a little bit on the newer side for the Retro Hour, but it was such an amazing story to kind of hear about, like how he worked with Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and, you know, Harold Ramis and, what's Winston's name, Dan? Don't tell me. What's his name?
Ernie Hudson.
Come on.
Like, call yourself a Ghostbusters fan.
It was so amazing to kind of like talk about, you know, the production of those games and, you know, how involved he was and essentially, you know, how he was directing like the voice actors in these games and stuff and stories about Matt Groening from The Simpsons. It was really, really amazing. So quite a long one, but, you know, absolutely top work from Ravi there as well, getting him on.
You know, you mentioned then that Hit and Run, you didn't think it was that retro. It came out in 2003. So that's 19 years ago.
Yeah, I guess.
That,
you know,
that is retro.
It's pretty retro. It's pretty retro. And Road Rage came before that. So it's getting pretty retro. But yeah, well, really, really top. Interview.
For me, it was like Simpsons games before that. I know you're a fan of Bart versus the Space Mutants and stuff like that and the arcade ones. But they were the rarities in a pile of poop. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, Simpsons Road Rage and Hit and Run, when it hit it, it really recreated Springfield for me. And it had that kind of vibe. So it's awesome to talk to John about it. And, you know, he's got such a good eye for this and the kind of brands, especially like going into Ghostbusters and some of the later stuff that he's done. But he also started on some really interesting titles. And it really is that story of coming from QA, going into producer, and the kind of changes in tech and just what that enabled. But of course, we went totally fanboy on the Simpsons stuff. And there's some really exciting stuff in this interview. I think it's going to be one that you're all going to really enjoy.
You know, Hit and Run as well. I mean, what a game. It's kind of like the Simpsons, but, you know, GTA style, isn't it?
Pretty much. And we actually asked him about that. You know, was the kind of the brief for Road Rage to be Crazy Taxi, and was the brief for, you know, Hit and Run to be GTA? And it wasn't quite as it seemed. There's actually a really interesting story behind it about how the studio kind of, they did Road Rage and then they were like, we want to get out of the car,
but they turned it platformy, didn't they? Not like GTA. It wasn't going to Ammunition.
It was blown away Chief Wiggum
section, sure.
But it was really interesting to kind of get that backstory and kind of talk about the reboots, you know, the potential kind of reboots and his thoughts on it. And, you know, kind of, it was very open about like, the kind of the money sides of it and stuff like that, which I thought was really nice. So really, really, really exciting stuff.
And even going into the 2009 Ghostbusters game, which and that might be pushing the boundaries of retro, admittedly, but the thing is, Ghostbusters, it's a retro franchise.
Yeah. Dan, you know, you've missed a gem here, you know. You're Mr. Resident Ghostbusters. And
And to me, you know, someone who, I loved Afterlife, you know, the latest Ghostbusters movie. Hype for the next one as well. But I think for me, Ghostbusters 2009, that was kind of the last time, obviously before Harold Ramis passed away. Mm. To a lot of fans, that was like kind of the real Ghostbusters 3.
Wow. So not to spoil it, he said it was like Dan Aykroyd kept on calling it Ghostbusters 3.
Yeah.
And he said there was a point where him, Harold Ramis, and, you know, and John were all on the phone and they were talking about it like, this is Ghostbusters 3, and it was called Ghostbusters 3. And he was like going back to the studio and it was like, we've got to call it Ghostbusters 3.
Don't give up the gold, Joe.
But they couldn't. I'm giving all the way to gold here, but like, there's so much. That's just the tip of the iceberg, honestly. Like, the way they got Bill Murray, because obviously Bill Murray's so like elusive. It's a really fantastic story.
So really hyped for this one. And you guys did this. I'm looking forward to listening to this one. John Melcher, our special guest, he'll be on the show in around 25 minutes from now. Now, a very in-depth interview. So let's quickly get through this week's news stories, because lots going on as well, including a pretty major Atari leak. Now, this is not something we see that often, because obviously a lot of these games now are, you know, knocking on 40 years. But obviously one of Atari's best arcade games, Marble Madness. Now, I played that game on the Amiga, the home version of it. Really enjoyed it as well. I played it on the arcade too. And I know that Marble Madness 2 was kind of a holy grail among retro enthusiasts and particularly Atari collectors, because this one never actually made it to market. But now there is a ROM that's been dumped for everyone to play.
It's pretty amazing. This is the prototype version that's been dumped. And Dan, did you play that with the trackerball when you originally played it, or were you a mouse noob?
I think on the Amiga I used a mouse, but I have played it on arcade on trackerball. I must admit, even though I like the game and I enjoy the physics of Marble Madness, I don't really get very far in it. It is a tough game.
For me, it was the music, the graphics, the atmosphere of it. You know, it's therapeutic, Marble Madness, to actually play. You know, it's got that vibe, and that's why this second version is so interesting, because it doesn't look therapeutic at all. It looks like they've added loads of absolutely insane elements in here that make it look more stressful than therapeutic. The music's still good, though.
Funny you should say that. One of my earliest ever memories is my brother renting Marble Madness for the Sega Mega Drive and me getting upset because it was so difficult that my dad took it back and rented his Tailspin instead, which coincidentally is a really hard game for the Mega Drive as well. But
that wasn't your weekend, was it?
It wasn't my weekend. But as Ravi said, this looks insanely difficult. There's like little bucket enemies and little spinning top enemies, like just all over the shop, like little like bouncing things that like shock you and send you flying. It looks really hard. But
it looks like pinball-y a bit, doesn't it?
You know, yeah, it does.
It's got that kind of pinball vibe.
Yeah, well, there is even a level where you're on a pinball table. It looks really tough. But what's the story here? Is it so? From what I understand, essentially the game went out to some testers, but then obviously it never got released. And essentially, the rumor is that this has actually come from one of the test carts that's been dumped.
Yeah, they the kind of Atari reportedly blamed it for the trackball controls, saying, "Oh, that was bad." And then they redid the control scheme, and then kind of replace a trackball with a joystick and an accelerator button, but that didn't go down well as well. So
I couldn't imagine playing Marble Madness with a joystick.
No, you know, and I think it was just they're trying to do too much with it here. Like, yeah, you look at the Marble Madness, it was like such a pioneering title, and now you look on YouTube and those videos of kids rolling marbles around the whole thing. Maybe they could have gone down like a Micro Machines route where it was like in a house or it was some kind of like level like that. But it just seems to be completely wacky. And Jason Scott with the Internet Archive got a great quote here. And yeah, he's just talking about how, you know, how wild it was and what a beautiful game it was. And the sequel kind of completely forgets why the original was great. Which is, yeah, pretty fair comment, to be honest.
You know, it kind of reminds me of, because, I mean, this second version of the game was meant to be released in the early 90s. The original Marble Madness was, I think, 84, which, you know, there was kind of a time when, you know, the kind of 16-bit technology was obviously the main platforms, you know, particularly in arcade hardware. There was a time when they tried to soup up and really do, like, turbocharged versions of these old arcade games from like a decade before. Like, you know, they did it with Pac-Man, didn't they, when Pac-Mania came out? It did seem to be a bit of a trend for a while that they kind of do these like crazy sequels. I actually think it looks all right. I know Jason Scott's saying it's a really uninteresting game and he hopes that now that it's out there, people can kind of move on from it. But I agree, Ravi, it looks like they're trying to do a bit too much in it, but it does kind of have that, you know, kind of wild kind of early 90s atmosphere to it, looking at the game.
Yeah, and like just the music is still like, oh, I kind of like get that feeling that you're in the Marble Madness world. It looks like it's kind of taken off a arcade real PCB as well, so that thing must be rare. And I can imagine people are going to now put this on their units, or maybe if they've got like a Jammer arcade or something with Marble Madness 1, they might put it in and try and give it a go. You know, we might get some Let's Plays on YouTube or something like that.
Yes, I mean, you can play that on MAME now. The ROM dump is available on archive.org. I mean, they don't mention kind of what state it's in. They say it's a second prototype version of it. It looks pretty complete from the video, though. So if you want to check
again,
that out,
it looks like 3D Blast as well, this version. But then, yeah, so 3D Blast kind of ripped off that as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think it does look fun, though. I mean, definitely something that, you know, not only a curiosity because it's kind of one of those lost games that everyone's talked about for decades, but it could be a bit of fun as well, I think. I've got a feeling I lost about 3 seconds in this version of it.
That's probably 2 seconds longer than me, though.
So if you want to get it on your main cab, I'll link that up, the link on archive.org in our show notes.
One question, guys. Did you find when you played that game, it was one of those games where when you're about to fall off the side, you're leaning to the side?
You're physically moving your body to
compensate for it.
Maybe that's what I needed to do as a kid to play better.
Lean into it, yeah.
And not cry.
It would have been good on kind of one of those you know, gaming chairs or like a joy board or something, maybe playing it that way.
If
someone wants to hack it and have that idea on me. Now, you're always a fan of these, Ravi, these kind of wildly expensive, very bizarre, beautifully made arcade machines. Now, this one is going to set you back over £4,500. But I've got to say, this is probably not meant for us lot. This is for those really trendy bars that you see in certain parts of the world who want something a bit unique in there. Now, this is a mid-century, they're calling this, modern-style arcade, a tabletop unit made by Capcade.
It looks cheap to me. it's an expensive
one. Does it look £4,500 to me?
But it looks like it came from IKEA. Or someone made it themselves, you know.
It has got that Danish kind of like Swedish look about it, actually, now you say it. But it's just the fact that they call it mid-century.
Yeah, so this isn't even tabletop mounted on anything, it's wall mounted. So you'd have to have a dedicated area in your room or something that you actually mount this on the wall, which also makes me think you're mounting something that's £4,000 on your wall that you're going to be slamming and bashing and stuff. You need to mount that pretty well. It's
not designed for the kind of dives that us guys go to. Though,
no, a beer would be spilled all over that, and the lovely wood would be stained. I think they're using special wood here, which is African Arako wood and a birch ply. Each piece is tailored to your requirements, apparently.
Handcrafted as well.
Handcrafted, yeah. And they've got Ultimark retro sticks, which I've not really heard of before, but they've got a Mister in their computer as well. Yeah. But the most disappointing thing for me is the CRT, well, LCD monitor. It is 4:3 ratio, but it's still LCD. And like, I don't know. I'd expect a CRT for this price.
I'm just, who's buying this?
It looks like an art install, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, like you say, £4,750. Like, it's just mental. Like, I mean, I want to say it's cool, but I think the Pandora box ones, which have got like all the artwork up the side and stuff, which I'm on Etsy now, people are selling for like £500 and £400. And I think they look much cooler and really capture that 80s and 90s like look. You know,
it'd be horrible
like the artwork
here, but
up the side.
It looks a bit like a urinal or like one of those metal ones that you get at a football ground.
Yeah.
The way that it kind of bends around. But yeah.
At £4,700, you don't want to make that mistake after a few pints.
What happened to your mid-century arcade, Joe? Well, Dan came over and he was really drunk.
So I'm not sure how many of these are going to sell.
It seems they're selling them in ones. So
I was
going to
say, it says there's only one available. So I'm assuming if you buy it, they hand make it and then they'll put another one for sale once it's done.
Waiting for that first order probably right now. Oof. So I've got to say, it doesn't look £4,700 worth of system, but I'm sure there will be somewhere with the money too. I have that kind of thing hanging on the wall, you know, for a bit of accolade maybe. So if you want to have a look at the pictures, I think that's enough for me, if I'm honest. I'll put that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, John Melcher, our special guest, coming up very soon. All those stories about games like Simpsons Hit and Run, Ghostbusters, talking about those early days at Sega. And we've got another Nintendo 64 prototype that's been found. We'll talk about it in just a moment. It seems to be a bit of a trend right now, that. But also, just a quick reminder that, you know, the reason that we can bring you this podcast each and every Friday is thanks to our incredible community of patrons who make sure that we can pay all the bills, we can keep the lights on here at Retro Hour Towers, and bring you a new podcast each and every week. And of course, we're not all take. We give back massively, I think, you know, compared to a lot of podcasts on Patreon.
Oh, yeah. We've got loads of stuff. Like, if you sign up, you get an ad-free episode. You also get the Retro Hour After Hours, which is an entirely different podcast where we're kind of talking about, like, our own memories, when we first experienced stuff. Recent episode was about the N64. And sometimes these episodes go on for 2 hours and you can get a whole feed. How many of them have we done now?
24.
So if you do join Patreon, you will get 24 brand new episodes, and that's pretty awesome. And
you'll be sick to death of us after that, listening to all that.
And we have our Google Meets as well, which is just so nice, like meeting up with all of the listeners and kind of having a big chat, like a big pub kind of Sunday sit down and chat about stuff and share stuff. It's really nice. And mostly, you know, you're supporting the show and you're keeping us independent. You've enabled us to buy all this equipment so we can do this from home and we can kind of do it in our own time and there's a lot less stress and we can actually produce it, because running a podcast every single week is pretty hardcore. And how many years have we done it now? I can't even remember.
6.5 years now we've done it.
6.5 years every week. Wow.
And we're talking about, you know, events that we're going to be going to this summer as well. I mean, you know, it helps us get there and record panels, you know, in far-flung parts of the world. We're going to Norway and Germany. We're going to bring you back reports and exclusive interviews from places like that too as well. So, I mean, having this money in Patreon just enables us to just keep doing the show and bring you stuff like that as well. So we can't stress, without Patreon, the show wouldn't exist. You know, to put it bluntly, 100%. We couldn't afford to do it out of our own pocket. So if you'd like to back us on there, honestly, it's massively appreciated. You'll find all the details at theretrohour.com. Now, it seems to be we're talking about new N64 builds and leaked prototypes that are found pretty much every week at the moment. Last week was a GameCube one. We talked about that Kirby one. This week, there is a game that was called SimCopter that did come out on the PC, didn't it, by Maxis back in the day. But there is now a playable build of the cancelled N64 version that's out there.
It's weird because there was sim stuff for absolutely everything. And I remember this kind of, so SimCopter was very like based on Rescue and stuff like that. But I remember there was this idea in SimCity, which was we want to go inside the city. We want to see what's going on in the city. And they tried to implement this with a SimCopter in the streets of SimCity as well. And it's like the technology couldn't handle it. It was really glitchy, sketchy. Like the textures as you'd go in weren't amazingly
good. That classic
good.
N64 fog.
Yeah. And it's like they did it later on with Command & Conquer as well, where they wanted to go into the game. And this happens with a lot of kind of strategy games where they're like, right, what, you know, someone obviously is in a meeting and they go, what if we could go inside the city?
Yeah.
It's got that kind of vibe. But interesting to see that there was a N64 port, because SimCity, you know, there's been a lot of Nintendo ports in the past, actually, and it's one of those titles that doesn't lend itself to going onto consoles.
Yeah, well, interestingly, footage of this game was put on YouTube in 2015, but with kind of like no explanation. So, you know, people have known it's existed for quite a while with, you know, footage and stuff, but
another one from E3, wasn't it? Another little glimpse.
Yeah, it was a glimpse.
Seems to be like a lot of them out there.
Yeah, glimpse from E3. But what's actually happened now is a Reddit user has posted this. He's called A707 North Bayer. And essentially, he's got a hold of the physical build engine cartridge of it. You know, the nice tall N64 cartridge, you know, when it's, you know, the kind of looks like two N64 cartridges on top of each other. Apparently, he bought it in a private sale. Where he traded a load of Super Nintendo games with a, you know, a private seller who's not said where they got it from. And then obviously he's kind of posted his footage and his pictures of the game running. Now, I must admit, this build, which is from the 26th of December 1997, apparently, looks a lot nicer on the picture that he's posted than it did in the footage from E3. I think it looks a lot more complete. And there's the draw distance with the N64 mist is a lot better. And there seems to be a lot more kind of going on the street level of the game. Like, you know, kind of like, you know, when you come down into the buildings and stuff, there seems to be more kind of happening in the streets and stuff, you know, like palm trees and stuff like that. He's not put the game out on ROM or anything like that yet for people to play, but he said that he's interested in making a backup of it to kind of preserve this slice of history so other people can play it as well. And then it's out there, isn't it? But it's always interesting when these games pop up. Like, you know, I can only assume the person he's done a trade with, you know, was a private collector who must have got it from probably one of the original, you know, developers of the game. And when the game got cancelled, just, well, rather than destroying it all, I'll take this home with me.
It must have come through Maxis somewhere. And that, like, there must have been a leak, or it would have been like a beta version. And like, it's an interesting game. Like, you're essentially a taxi service flying around to different parts of the city, and you've got to like chase speeders and stuff. But one function that really made it stand out was like the soundtrack. So it had like radio stations in there, like GTA style.
Oh, really?
Like original rock, techno, jazz. So you could kind of listen to the helicopter radio and fly around. And I wonder if that would have been on the N64 version because of the cartridge and stuff, as opposed to like CD, you know.
That's pretty cool.
It is interesting. So it reminds me a bit of Pilot Wings. Looking at it, kind of getting a vibe from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is, like you said, that Reddit user, his name is A707 North Bayer. Interestingly, since it's got picked up by Nintendo Life and other sites, he's actually now deleted the thread of Reddit. And the videos that he posted there have kind of all gone now. Now, I've been looking back through his history. There is a few links to kind of silent videos that he posted on Imgur. So you can check those out, you know, kind of see a bit of the gameplay. It does look legit. And he's saying, I think the reason, I've got a feeling that the reason he's deleted the thread is from looking through the history of it, he was getting hammered by so many people going, oh, give me a copy of it, I'll help you out, you know, can you sell it to me? And I just think he got a bit fed up of everyone going on at him.
Yeah.
But he did say he wants to sell it, he said.
Oh,
I've got a feeling he wants to. Yeah, he wants to sell it and earn money off it, by the sounds of it. He doesn't want to give it away.
Okay,
But he said he is going to dump it, though. He's looking at backing it up and releasing it.
Oh, okay, so he's going to dump the ROM, but then he wants to sell the physical
sell
cartridge.
The original.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, but I just think he got a bit fed up, because, I mean, that thread, it was like, you know, there's a lot of comments on it, and it's kind of been a bit of a holy grail, I think, for N64 collectors.
You know, it makes me want to play SimCopter again, because there's so many of these other Sim titles that I've not explored properly, and I've just like briefly seen, and it's like, actually, you know,
so it does look an interesting title. It just, you know, there seemed to be like Sim everything during the 90s, didn't there? So
that would be a good one, Sim everything.
Sim
everything.
All of them combined. So yeah, if you want to check out the footage of that, I'll find the links to the the videos that I've found so far. I'll put them in the show notes as well, and hopefully that will be available for everyone to enjoy before long. Now, this looks pretty interesting. Now, we've talked a lot on this show about people making their own kind of homebrew portable retro consoles. This one is a little bit different because it uses a CRT.
Yeah, this is a really mad, really well thought out concept. And do you remember when you used to have video cameras like VHS cameras, and you'd have the viewfinder in the in the camera that you'd like put your eye against, and you'd
monochrome normally.
Sometimes monochrome, sometimes later on it was color. Well, that was a little CRT essentially, the viewfinder. So it's a source of CRTs that kind of haven't been used, you know, these old video cameras. And it's really quite a small CRT. you know, you're just holding it up to your eye, but,
and a lot of those were magnified as well, weren't they? It'd be like the size of your fingernail.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a little magnifying
screen. But this seems to fit like amazingly well with the Pico 8. So this Pico 8 language we've covered before. And Pico 8's display is limited to 128 by 128 pixels. And this guy has managed to actually create a little device that's 3D printed. It's called the OneFum Entertainment System. It's Raspberry Pi powered, and it's got this little CRT and only one button on it. And it kind of looks like a really thin, tiny old camera, doesn't it?
Yeah, with one button, literally.
That's it.
So you kind of hold it. It's got like a hand strap. Imagine like an old, like you said, an SVHS or a Hi8 camera. You put your hand through, kind of wrap your palm around the console. You put the viewfinder up to your eye, and then there's a small red button near it that, I guess, it's going to be only certain types of games are going to work with this. I was going to say you're not going to play Doom on this, but I'm sure someone will port it.
Yeah, there's probably a Pico 8 version of Doom, I bet you.
So, yeah, it looks an interesting device. And again, it's just, you know, it's unique, isn't it?
Yeah,
nothing like this I've ever seen.
It's kind of like you can get CRTs in loads of different places that you really didn't think about them. And, you know, as the supply is getting limited, they're getting broken. Like PVMs, if you want to buy one of them nowadays, you're fighting all the retro geeks across the land. I'm sure you can pick up an old broken camera in a charity shop and kind of follow these guys' like instructions, and then 3D print the case, and then you've actually got this like really weird thing. I don't know, it kind of looks a bit like a gun, but then I think a lot of the old cameras kind of did, you know, with the whole shoot and point kind of thing, and the lingo's always been very similar with cameras and guns. But I wouldn't take this to an airport or anything like that. Like, what's he looking through? Is this weird viewfinder, who's he aiming at, you know?
It does look a bit like a military kind of tool.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. Or like, you know, one of those things that they use in battle where they go, we're going to bomb here, and it's like a laser range.
With a red button on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. Like so, targeting someone, you know.
You know, I always like projects like this where they kind of find uses for places that you wouldn't expect to go into video games. So like you said, I mean, the amount of cameras or camcorders that, you know, lying around in people's cupboards and that. So it is nice to kind of repurpose those parts into something usable again. I'm not sure what kind of, I'm looking at this guide here, you know, if you've got a bit of electronics knowledge, it looks doable.
Yeah, this isn't easy.
no, but it's, I just wonder what kind of games you're going to play in it. You know what I mean? It's maybe something like Duck Hunt might work in it or something. I'm not sure, but just having that one button is obviously going to kind of limit it, I imagine. But it just kind of seems like one of those projects, you do it just because you can.
Yeah, or maybe you can make a wall like a tiny wall out of all these little CRTs. And then you could have a full PVM.
A portable video wall you can take anywhere with you. So it's very cool. So if you want to check that out, I'll link that up, and everything else we talked about, you find all our stories in our show notes every week in your podcast app or at theretrohour.com. Now, before we chat to this week's special guest, John Melcher, he's on the way in just a minute talking about games like The Simpsons Hit and Run, Ghostbusters, and lots more as well. Let's take a moment to welcome on this week's sponsor, and it is a new sponsor for the Retro Hour podcast that we're very excited to have on board, and this is our mates at Shopify. Now, if you use Shopify, this sound will be like music to your ears. Because that's the sound that you hear when you've made money, essentially, when you've made a sale on Shopify. And actually, I know you and I, Ravi, were very excited that Shopify come on board because, you know, in our various side hustles and businesses and companies that we've worked with, we've both used Shopify for quite a long time.
Yeah, so I'm a web designer in my kind of side hustle spare time. And a lot of my clients want like an all-in-one commerce platform. And I can't really provide that. So Shopify do it, but they do it for people without skills in design, or they don't need to know anything about coding. It's a really nice platform, and it's also scalable as well. So you can start off small and then grow big.
Yeah, and the thing is, they just take, like you said, all the hassle out of doing it. Because I've got a friend who's an author, and he published his first couple of books recently. And again, like a lot of the people you work with, no web design skills. I mean, he can barely sign into a WordPress website, yeah. But Shopify just takes all the hassle out. I mean, it makes a payment simple, accepts all the major payment methods that you need as well. And what I really love about it is you've got this dashboard in there that gives you all the insights that you need to grow your business as well, where you can manage orders, shipping, payments, all of that from anywhere too. And I mean, for someone like you, if you're setting it up for someone else, the good news is they've got 24/7 support, so they can help every step the way.
Yeah, that's awesome, and it really stops me kind of having to do it. And also, you know, you can start selling on Shopify for free, which is really good.
Yeah, so actually we'd love you to give Shopify a try for yourself and take your business to the next level. And if you use our exclusive link so they know that we sent you, then of course it's going to really help out the podcast as well. So sign up right now and get a free 14-day trial at shopify.co.uk/retrohour. So that's all lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour right now to grow your business today. shopify.co.uk/retrohour. And a big thank you to our friends at Shopify for their support of our show. Right, then next, we've got a fantastic guest on the show for you this week, getting stories from those early days at Sega doing Q&A, and then into games like, you know, Simpsons Road Rage, Hit and Run, and Ghostbusters as well. What a guest. Our special guest, John Melcher, is next on the Retro Hour podcast.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with John Melcher. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for joining us. We always start with one question, and this will take you back. What was your first kind of video game experience, or the first time you ever saw a video game or an arcade?
Well, I was a big, dating myself, arcade person back in the early to mid-80s, and as I was going through the tweens into high school. I'd say the first home system I had was the Atari 2600, bought it new. And then the first real deep dive into gaming I did is on the Commodore 64, if you remember that. That's where I really started to understand, like, oh my God, these are more than just pixels moving across screen. These have narratives, they have stories, they have deep systems or deeper systems at the time. But then I think, as far as the wonder of it all, I went to a miniature golf course and I saw a Dragon's Lair machine for the first time.
Yeah.
And that attract, just the attract mode of the Bluth animation and sound, I was hooked. I you know, back then you used to put quarters on top of the arcade to line up who was next.
And they were notorious machines because they'd always break as well. So was it operating well when you had it?
It was operating. I don't think I ever played it long enough for it to break. because it's a game that is based on failure. So I would always choose the wrong direction and then end up as a skeleton. And then somebody who's much larger and much more physical than I is would say move.
Well, were you doing any like basic programming and stuff on the C64?
No, I mostly stick to the creative and design stuff. But like I did, they had a tape recorder in which you learn. You know, they had a how to make a game app or program back then, and I did try to do enough to make things move around. But I realized I was not smart enough for that. Like I could only go so far. But I had vested interest from the Commodore 64 days of how games work and how they were built.
Awesome. So I read online you kind of started your career as a quality assurance tester with Sega of America in the early 90s. How did that come out? Was it Was it like a, were you interested in making gaming kind of like your career, or did you just kind of fall into it? What's the story there?
Both. I fell into it, but I had interested in making games and understanding games for a long time. But I was working at my father's video store, and I think trying to figure out what was next. And my wife knew somebody that worked at Sega. And,
yeah.
She said, this is a great opportunity, but she said, you are doing this because it's more of a career than working at your father's store.
Yeah.
I started, she got me the job in the industry, and she got me the job at Sega as the quality assurance, starting on the night crew, which started like 3 p.m. to like 2 a.m.
And what was the culture like? What was that like? Was it, was it kind of like burning the midnight oil, or was it fun?
It was a sweatshop a bit, but like, so like, the way Sega worked back then is 95% of the staff was on contract for like 6 months, and then the percentage was full time, and everybody tries to work hard on their quality of bug count to do it. I think the amount of products that went through both first and third party was massive, and the amount of testing hours that we put in was a lot, but I would say it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I connected with production a lot and some of the engineers in Japan, but like the longer I was there, the more I started working on their sports titles, their World Series and title and their Joe Montana football title. And then there was a close group net of sports fans in the group. As you can know from quality assurance, there's probably very few sports fans in there. There's a lot of like obviously gamers that like the fighting games and adventure games. So we kind of got shifted to the back corner because nobody wanted to hear us cheer for ourselves when we played, because we started playing rather than testing.
Yeah.
And like there was one day where they're like, okay, you tie every game in the baseball game. And we got so competitive, we just couldn't do it. Like this true story is like, I'm from Cleveland originally, so I'm a big fan of all the Cleveland sports teams. And like my coworker was also from Cleveland, and our lead tester, Todd Morgan was his name. He says, please play with the Indians and make sure you tie every game. So we played a 7-game series and we didn't even check UA, and it actually shipped with the Indians spelled wrong. I think it was Indidians. And he That's couldn't brilliant. Fathom how two guys from Cleveland could miss the spelling of their sports team. But it was a 7-game series and it went 7, so the intensity was elsewhere.
Did you kind of start to learn games in and out then, and realize what makes a good game, and what aspects were required for a game?
That was very educational for me, because like to your point, like we would give bug feedback, and then you see how they fix the bugs, so you start to understand how they're creating the games. And then, but the thing is, like we would give, sometimes they'd ask for creative feedback, and then the answers you'd get from either the designers or the engineers would help form an opinion about why they make those decisions.
Yeah,
because it's important to understand what a game isn't as much as what it is and its design and its core systems. And I think when you start as a tester, you're like, oh, I want Sonic to fly and all this stuff. And then when somebody starts to say, here's the brand and here's why we don't do that technologically in the system and here's why the design doesn't want to do that, you start to find your swim lanes. You fight to understand why decisions are made, both in time, quality, and budget. But all decisions have a purpose. I never really found there or at EA that decisions were made just ad hoc. Everything had a grounded effect on what the core pillars of the experience, brand, license, or game is. And I think that's what you learn in QA.
Yeah,
you learn the games are always broken, but you also learn like the decision making and what they fix, how they fix it, and why they fix it is very interesting.
Did any of your input kind of actually get taken up on a game, and did you manage to get any changes made?
I think there was the 32X game, obviously a very popular system. The Fred Couples 36 Greatest Holes of Golf, I think it was, and we did give feedback on the swing meter and how it would work. with the controller, and they did put that into the game, if I remember. And there was also, like, if you remember the Genesis days, there was a multi-tap that turned it so four players could play at once, but it never really worked correctly. We did a lot of feedback on some of their sports games about how the multi-tap would work and how that would connect. And I think they took a little bit of that feedback, but most of it was my first creative, like, oh, a win was the swing meter in Fred Couples. And it was like three or four of us that really worked hard and like, this isn't working as a golf game. Mm. Maybe they should try this. And they actually did listen.
So you mentioned briefly there about Electronic Arts. You moved to EA in 95 and you became an assistant producer. What's the story there? Was that kind of like you said, you know, working in the QA team there, you actually started to learn a lot about like decisions what were made in the game and what goes into a game and stuff. Was that the reason that you wanted to go into that kind of role, or did it just kind of happen?
I would say I'm a big sports gamer, and you start to learn after a period of time that the games you love to play aren't necessarily the ones you should be making. Mm-hmm. But I was a big sports guy all the way through gaming stuff. So like when an opportunity opened up, a coworker of mine moved over to EA and he says, hey, there's an opening over there. I jumped at it. And the reason I was debating back and forth was staying in QA full time because I got the offer, or going there and doing a role that I didn't quite understand. But one of our good coworkers did not get the full-time position, and he had just gotten married and had a kid and needed it. So one of the reasons I went over was I had a full-time job in what I thought was a dream job, but also provided him a chance to get a full-time job and not be out on the street. And I say that like, 'cause I think I sound good when I say that, but I was always going to take the EA job. I'll just take credit for him staying in. Now that I say it out loud, it sounds horrible.
No, it was a really sweet story. And then you did kind of say that part, but either way, you both ended up in a good position, which was great. So
I don't think you ever thanked me. So you know what?
Brilliant. And what was the culture like at EA? Was it, because obviously EA, lots of sports titles, lots of sporting games and stuff like that, really, really popular, you know, especially in the mid-90s for sports games and stuff. So were you kind of in your element all of a sudden, you know, or was it a complete different, like, you know, shock to the system kind of thing?
It's a bit of a shock to the system, and why, like, High Score, which is the division that did sports out of San Mateo, it was really the Delta House of Interactive, right, at the time. Because this is, you know, Scott Orr was a major influence on me and a major Mount Rushmore of sports gaming. And he ran that division and he was an incredible mentor. And like, he had a very loose culture, right? Which is like, you know, let's talk about it. Let's find out what's best for the game. Let's take the license. And so like, it was, you know, when you come from a regimented, like, here's a test plan, here's what you're testing and here's what you're checking the box to, what makes the best game was the right thing for him to do. But like coming into that was relatively new experience. So like, what am I basing my decision on? You know, you're basing your decision on what you think is best for the game with as a team. And so it was went from very regimented to very little Wild West a bit. But he and that team and the way that it was run, there's a great support system. And it was ended up being a great culture. I think where sports kind of suffered is like when they became very corporate through success. Mm. That old West style of making games of everybody just doing their jobs and it being run by Scott and his vision, I think just got squeezed a bit.
Did you work much with Andrew Anthony and the kind of voicing his motto, it's in the game? Did you get to meet him at all and kind of be around that period?
I only met him once. I didn't work with him. I just like, you know, whenever we had, you know, whether it's Andretti Racing, which became NASCAR, or Knockout Kings, or any of the Maddens, except for the year it didn't ship, and hockey, except for the year it didn't ship, he's always around for the commercials or the thing. But like, he was funny because he's such an icon in sports of that era, and like the generation that grew up with sporting games back in the 90s and 2000s know him so well. But like my son, who he really enjoys EA sports games for the most part, I bring him up as like, that's a guy that's in the game, right? You smile, he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I was like, well, he was a big deal back then.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with Overblood then? And what was that like?
So Overblood, that was a great experience because like, so basically, I think it's out there. So like the year Madden didn't ship, it creates a vacuum of revenue. Mm-hmm. And so the division was looking for options that they could do quality games and fill a hole. And that game was doing well in Japan. And I don't remember who brought it over, but Michael Pohl presented it to us, who was our boss at the time. and said, this is a game that we could bring to this market. That fills a need that we have, but also is a really cool stepping stone for maybe HighScore doing other types of games. Mm. You know, because EA at the time had the Jane's division, which did simulators, and it had underneath that division, you know, the Jungle Strikes and then the Road Rashes of that group. And then you kind of had sports. And then Maxis with The Sims. But like, so he brought it over, and that was really interesting because like we recast it with American actors. We tried to, we hired some writers to try to Americanize the script, but like it was so new for our division to make kind of an adventure puzzle game. And I think if I remember correctly, Resident Evil, not to compare it to Resident Evil, and but had just come out. So that kind of like spooky survival horror kind of third person was popular. So I think, it was a very interesting experience because that was my first experience learning localization and what that entails and how you have to match each of the voice files. That was in my early 20s to the exact length of the voice file that was currently there, or it kind of screws up the system. But it was it was definitely a fun experience because it was something completely new that I had never done or seen.
Was there a lot of pressure for it to be, you know, as successful as, say, Resident Evil? Because obviously they're not massively similar games, but, you know, they, at the end of the day, they're both survival horrors. And also, as you mentioned, to kind of fill that void of there's no Madden this year. So how did that feel?
I think there's pressure on getting it done. I think everybody had realistic expectations. I think both Scott and Michael kind of knew there was never going to be a Resident Evil because that was obviously like a watershed game that became its own herb in games, right? But I think the pressure on getting it done at a high enough level where it would make a dent and people would care. And care is subjective too. Care about the characters, care about the story, the gameplay, whatever it was. But when we completed it, we felt like we did justice to the game that the core game, because we didn't change much of the game outside some cultural stuff. And we Americanized it a bit. And I think it fit exactly what the port was coming over from Japan. And I think it hit its mark, but I think the expectations were definitely tempered. There was never going to be Resident Evil.
So you also helped produce Firefight and Extreme Pinball for EA. What was the experience like there? What were you doing there? Were you localizing the games, or were you more involved with those ones?
Those also were like kind of value propositions that were brought to us through Michael Pohl. And I remember, you know, the pinball was Epic Games, which I think they went on to great success. So like, and Mark Rain and those teams. And those were fun because we took that game. My job was to take it and put it on the PlayStation, which was unique for that. And then the scrolling camera and how that would work. So trying to get that to fit on a PlayStation and then be readable and playable when the screen's scrolling with the ball, which, you know, in pinball, you kind of like your hands are on the pedals waiting to flip those back up. And then sometimes the screen was rotating, it'd be off, but that was a fun, and Happy Keller was the producer of that. He did a really good job because he's a big pinball guy. So he understood that. The firefight was like, it was a very interesting opportunity because like, I loved that game because of the multiplayer aspect. It's a little bit like Worms and the fact that you can like take on somebody individually in a large scale, but like it's just pieces of the puzzle as you're playing it. And it had some great effects on there, and it had some great parallaxing, and it looked great. And that marketing for that game I thought was unique because it was multiplayer and they didn't think that marketing would push the agenda of that. So they put two discs in the box.
Yeah, I was going to say that's really weird, like having two discs. So it kind of be like, you'd get a friend involved
and right.
kind of get them on board. And it was network and modem play as well, wasn't it?
It was correct. We thought, you know, on the first part, you're like, oh, this is really cool because you can say, I have a friend and I'm going to hand him a disc. But then we were like, what if the person says no? How like off-putting is that? Like, would you like to play a game with me? Like, here's it free. Like, I'm going to pass. We felt strongly that game would be more well received than it was, but I think because of the two discs, the box, and the way, the time in which it came out, because I think Command & Conquer was out at the same time and kind of changing the genre of multiplayer into RTS, I think it never quite found the audience.
You were credited to writing the story with Firefight. How involved with that were you?
It was a team effort, but like, I'm a big narrative person, and you'll see in my career as we go on, like, I do a lot of like writing, and like, I think it needed one, and the developer didn't have one. So, you know, I said, like, I'd take a shot at it. I wrote it, and a lot of people gave feedback on it, but it was a fun experience because, like, you know, coming up, like, you already had the mechanics, you already had the code, you already had the game, but coming up with a conceit and characters and a purpose was very unique to me and a very big challenge. And I, you know, the support system in EA helps with that because there's lots of people that do that very well, EA, like, especially on the Jungle Strike series, had a great storyline, usually comical, but like, it was fun, but it was a challenge to say, okay, like, why am I here? And what am I doing as a not as a player, but like as a character within the universe. And what is the universe's definitions? And back then, they didn't define it as much as we do now. But like, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of like, I remember somebody says, oh, you wanted, you're kind of a writer. Would you like to write the story for the game? And I was like, yeah. And as soon as they left, I was like, what the hell what am I going to do here? I have a blank piece of paper with a icon, like just blinking on a blank piece of paper, like once upon a time. So, but it was fun, but it was definitely a shallow end of the pool kind of story.
Well, talking of pool, you worked on a title, Virtual Pool, and you also worked on Virtual Deep Sea Fishing. What was it kind of like becoming a producer then and doing that full role? And also, like, there was a lot of pool and kind of pinball games that ended up getting onto the consoles and stuff. Do you think that was a trend that quickly disappeared?
I do, I think, because I think short session games like pinball, well, there's still, Zen does very well today, right? They do a very good job with the pinball stuff. And I think there's always a market for that, because I think people who are intimidated by large games and, you know, the accessibility of physical pinball machines isn't there. So a lot of people don't like the bells and whistles and gameplay that, I think. But yeah, it's, now that you put it that way, I did a lot of like weird stuff. But like the Virtual Deep Sea Fishing was like funny, because I remember somebody had an idea, like there was a bill that like we should do a Virtual Deep Sea Fishing game. I just remember the dead silence in the room. Like, what the F? Who would ever play a deep sea, like a virtual deep sea fishing game? And like, so we did it. And like, you know, the first time you catch a marlin, you're like, this is really fun. Like, and then the 4 hours goes by before you catch another marlin, you're like, that isn't very fun. But like, it was, I think it sold like somewhere between like 500 to 700,000 copies. And we were like, I just remember going to my review that year and be like, yeah, I it was my idea. Like, I wanted to do deep sea fishing. Like, this is like you're welcome. And it's completely changing the narrative of the green light meeting. And like Virtual Pool, I did Virtual Pool 64 for Interplay. And that studio had already been a master class at making pool games on the you know, on other systems. And so they were trying to put it on, that was with Nintendo, and the N64 was taking off, and they were trying to put it on there. So that was a hard thing to try to get all their physics and all the way they do the bumpers, all the way down, you know, even snooker. Like, to get that on that cart was a feat, but I would say that the heavy lifting was done by the developer of that one. I just kind of guided them through, like, clearing. Like, I felt like my job as a producer in that game was to clear the field in front of them, because they already knew what they're already master class at that genre.
Yeah.
Like, what would I add? Like, oh, could you add a more shimmy to the ball? Like there's nothing I can add without looking like an idiot. But, like, the hardest jump in games is associate producer to producer, in my opinion. I was talking to a couple coworkers about that. It is like, as an associate producer, you're like, I'm the most important person in the game. God damn it, it doesn't ship, and you're one of 30 or one of 10, depending on the game, or one of two. But when you're the producer, they're like, okay, now it's, you kind of make a lot of decisions on a day-to-day, and like, you have half the budget of most games and no resources other than the APs who think they're God, and like, go make the game. And it's just like, you know, and Interplay's culture is very, very unique. And the fact that they kind of just like, okay, here's Virtual Pool, here's this game. I'm going to close the door on the way out. You have fun. There really wasn't the support system the EA had with the infrastructure.
As a producer, would you kind of have a lot of responsibility on your head, and then have to go to, you know, the big meetings and like justify decisions and stuff?
As a producer, absolutely. You have, you like, you know, EA had a thing called Ore Staff. Which, you know, I gratefully I did not have to attend as a producer, but that was a kind of a closed door meeting with just the team, and Scott Orwood sit at the end of the table. It was like, you show your game and everybody can criticize it, but you know, you couldn't talk about it outside of the room because we were a team. And it was really the funny thing, the peer pressure of like Madden's doing 3D flags, but the college football game, my game only has sprites. Oh my God, we're getting hammered. How do we do 3D flags? The amount of pressure you put on yourself to make the games better because you didn't want to go in there and be embarrassed by your peers made those games great.
Yeah.
And I guess trying to get people to understand as well and stuff, especially when you've got your kind of neck on the line, it's it must be a task.
It is. My wife and my father-in-law and everybody, what does a producer do? And I always say it's like half cheerleader, half warden, 100% evangelist.
Right? I like that.
All three of those, like you said, when you go to the big meetings, you're going to be one of those three people. And it's just like, you have to support the game no matter what it's going through as an evangelist.
Yeah.
But it's being a producer, you have to be a chameleon, because every person, you have to have a connection to every person on the team. And then some people might like this sport or this TV show. And you kind of have to like connect with them on those levels and discuss that, where they feel like you're listening to them and you are listening to them, but you kind of know what they're, what they like, and you kind of like it too. And, you know, I'll talk about Dancing with the Stars in one cube and then walk across the way and then talk about, yeah, did you see the hockey game last night? It was awesome.
Like, yeah.
Just, you have to be that person, because once you lose a team, you lose it forever.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously not a producer, but in my 9 to 5, if you will, I'm actually a manager at an insurance firm. And I completely agree with that. You know, you talk to one individual and like you say, it's how the kids, how's this? And then you go and talk to the young guy and it's, oh, you know, how was your weekend? Did you drink? Did you know what I mean? You've kind of got to like keep the team going, you know, you've always got to, I know it sounds silly, but I can imagine as a producer, there's just so much pressure to kind of do that all the time. So you kind of, you touched on the culture interplay there, you know, how it was kind of like, you know, shut the door, go do your thing. Did you struggle with that or did you just get on with it? Because your stint at Interplay was only for a couple of years, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so a couple of things about Interplay for me that kind of galvanized my career is I think it's the biggest failure I had at the beginning, because I came from such a structured support system at EA.
Mm.
And I think I struggled, I think I had like 5 or 6 games. And I did struggle quite a bit, but I think all of them but one shipped on time. But I would say I learned a lot through failure on that one, because I just didn't know what I didn't know when I got in. But what I did learn near the end was how to guerrilla produce, like how to trade with another producer for assets or people that I need, an engineer versus the artist, and get favors like that, and ask people to try to follow you into hell, right, for a heavenly cause to make the game. And I learned a lot about that. And that to me is like, you know, producing is about doing whatever it takes to get it done.
Yeah.
And I think I failed for a while at Interplay, but I really learned how to leave the EA support system behind and really learn how to actually just produce the game and you're responsible for it. I always tell people, like, producer job is to solve an unsolvable problem every day. And then the executive producer's job is, he looks at a Rubik's Cube with a sticker missing. It's literally unsolvable every day. And then you solve it. You go home and congratulate yourself. You wake up the next day and there's even more problems. Like, making games is a contact sport. And I think Interplay and I, as I learned to be a better producer, I think, but I had such a rough start there. I don't think we were ever going to mesh.
So is that why you moved to Fox Interactive? Because you moved there in the early 2000s, didn't you?
I did. And then the opportunity. So Fox was getting into sports when when I went there. And I think the Interplay was a great, there's a lot of great people there, right? Obviously Blizzard spot off on that, and Morheim and Pardo and those guys and you know, Fargo and those guys are all great guys. I just don't think I was ever going to mesh there with my personality and the impressions of when I got there versus when I left it. I was a different person, but I don't think either of us saw that. But Fox wanted to do sports, and they knew that I came from EA, so they hired me to do sports. And so that's how I got the job at Fox.
Oh, okay. So with Fox, was it kind of scary? Because obviously, I didn't realize you went into doing the sports games initially, but obviously, you ended up working on really huge IPs like The Simpsons and the Futurama and stuff. So, you know, my next question was going to be, was that a scary thought process? But I'm guessing you kind of went into sports games, which you were quite comfortable with initially.
It was a very awkward first day because I remember my boss was leading me around and he introduces me to the producer. I'll leave nameless because it's not fair to them. But like, he's like, John will be working on golf and football. And the producer's like, but I'm the producer of golf. And my manager's like, exactly. And I was like, this is a really awkward moment. So quickly, I think Gremlin was making a soccer game for them. And I think Radical, which is obviously a very good developer, was making our basketball and hockey game. And both doing very well. Like, I think I wasn't on basketball, but I was on hockey. And the hockey, you know, we were getting there, and it was a really good team. And obviously Cam Weber was running that team, who, you know, now runs Tiburon. But like, that Fox quickly learned that what a lot of people have learned over the years in interactive entertainment is they're not going to be able to compete with EA.
The
cost of entry, just for the licenses alone between the Players Association and the leagues, is a big pill. And you know, Fox got into it thinking Fox Sports was going to support that as a backbone, right? It's in the game as Fox Sports because they did the local, you know, sports channels purchase.
Yeah.
But they were never going to be able to compete with EA. I don't think movie studios in general invest in games like they should, obviously.
Yeah.
And they were never going to pay the price to that. So basically it kind of fell apart. And I'm a fairly sarcastic person. So like my boss was like, hey, you know what? Like, we have a license. Michael Pohl, actually, who I worked with at EA, joined. And he's like, we have this amazing IP called The Simpsons. And there's a Bart versus the World on the NES, I think.
Yeah.
So like,
I think there was a bowling one as well.
It's just bad, 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 bad. He says, how do we make it great? So like, I took that as a challenge because, you know, Simpsons were relatively in its heyday back then, right? But it's like, it's right when it was hitting its wheelhouse. And like, so we went to Radical and said, because we liked them as a developer, what do you have as far as an engine? They had a driving engine because they had done a driving game before.
Mm.
And we talked about like kart racing, right? And so I went to Matt Groening and Gracie Films, and neither of them were interested in a kart racing game because I think at that point, everything had a kart racing game. And Matt said to me, he's like, listen, like, for my humor to work at its best and through sarcasm and you know, objective humor, I need two people talking, right? Mm. It's back and forth. It's not like observational, like I'll make a joke about a rock. There's visual humor, but most of it back then was the dialogue between the characters and the gap between expectation and result of the line. So like we went back to Radical and then we came up with like, okay, you know, a delivery system, right? Which was initially going to be a tow truck, this, and it's just like, I wanted, like, I'm avoiding the topic of Crazy Taxi, but like, it was going to always be that.
Yeah, that was one of our questions. You're answering it for us already.
Like, there was discussions about like what tow truck driver or bus driver. Like, we just tried to, like, at the end of the day, Simpsons about parody, right?
Yeah,
and, like, making fun of things that are pop culture. And I think, you know, at that point, Crazy Taxi was popular, but it had run its course, right? Mm-hmm. So like, we made the decision, like, we're going to make a delivery game. And it was never like we set out to copy Crazy Taxi. We're just going to we're going to make a delivery game, which the humor is between the characters talking, because Crazy Taxi didn't have that.
But also, I felt that, like you said, there were a lot of Simpsons titles before there, like Virtual Springfield and stuff like that. I felt The Simpsons was kind of a bit like the South Park games, where they hadn't really, you know, fully gone for them yet. And then it with Road Rage and stuff, it kind of... it found its home and it found its style. You know, they tried so many different ones. I do remember in the early days as well, they used to have some quite good side-scrolling platformers as well, like Bart versus the Space Mutants and stuff. Did you look back at some of these older titles at all?
We looked at the Konami game, the arcade game, because it was very popular, right? Like, and there's a Cartoon Maker, right? It was very popular.
Yeah,
and the Virtual Springfield was also popular for its time because it was accurate. But I think when it came down to it, I think the difference was we got Gracie, which brings us the writers, and we got Matt to be involved rather than approve objects and lines and mechanics. They got involved in the making of the game, and they were involved with, like, you know, what's the story, and the writers took over and wrote the lines of dialogue. And, you know, we would write placeholder ones, and they would either approve them or punch them up. They came up with the conceit, but Matt would review the builds and have his kids play them. And Gracie was far more integrated in this process. So I think, like Ghostbusters, but like you add the DNA of the people who are creating the universe, and they're not just approving somebody else renting the universe. It made a big difference. And granted, they could be very difficult to work with at times because they're really good at what they do and their geniuses in the universe in which they create, right? Because they live in that universe.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we're just borrowing it for a period of time. So, but I think the big jump in those games, to try to answer your question, is like the people who created The Simpsons were helping create this game. And before that, they were approving things that were shown to them.
Do you think that the technology as well, like, you know, going onto the PlayStation 2 and on the GameCube, really helped with the ability to kind of tell the story and, you know, the CG graphics that were in there and using the actual, like, Simpsons assets and stuff like that?
I think so. I think that helped a lot. I think it created lots of problems because Road Rage was in competition and with a game called Simpsons Skateboarding that was being made at the same time. And my goal in life was to beat that game in quality and everything. Like, it was like, I could not be less of a team player to try to make that work. But I do think that the biggest debate was, because we went that way, what does Homer look like in 3D? It was a huge debate with both Gracie and Matt. These characters are going to be 3D. And then, you know, Lisa's shown from certain angles, and if you make her in 3D, your back of her head looks like a mace. And so we went through lots of feedback about, and granted, when, you know, back then you're like, oh, these look amazing in 3D, but you look back now, it's like PS1, you're like, oof. But like, there was a lot of debate and development that Radical had to help with and try to create these characters in 3D for Gracie and Matt to approve them.
just kind of touching on like approvals and, you know, restrictions and stuff like that. Like it was, it sounds amazing, you know, that like Matt and Gracie were like really hands-on. I didn't realize how hands-on they were, but was there any sort of like restrictions or guidelines you had with the characters? You know, was there any instances of like Fox kind of, you know, putting their foot in the way and saying, actually, you can't do that? Or, you know, was it pretty free sailing, if you will?
It was, I think it's never free sailing with the Simpsons writers because they can be very out there and they're very like, lawyers of Fox, like, you're not saying that.
Yeah.
which came up a lot that the writers are like, what? So yeah. but you have a little bit of that. But I think once we had the construction of the pillars of the game that, you know, the characters match the vehicles match the characters, we knew which characters would be delivered by what character. And we had all the lines kind of set up and we kind of had a quasi map of Springfield of where they would be going and seeing. I think that, you know, Radical was given free reign to make the best game possible. But the story, the lines, the timing of the lines were always going to be controlled by Fox.
Yeah.
And specifically Fox underneath that is Gracie and Matt were always present, always present.
And the map was great as well, because it introduced like a feature that we have in Hit and Run as well, which is just great little shortcuts and kind of back alleys and, you know, being able to explore the map in a different way. Was it a kind of accurate representation of Springfield, or was it more designed for the gameplay, this one?
I think Road Rage was a representation of Springfield as we saw it on that day. Because I think the show moves things around for shots, right? I think I don't think a detailed map at that point had really existed, because things had moved around. But like, we felt on Hit Run, we hit it. We got it right in spacing. I felt like Road Rage is a bit landmarkish, right?
Yeah.
You have these buildings under this cone of lights in which you're delivering, and Wall Falls in between them had to be scaled a little different because you're going back to them at high speed so they could read, but you're never going to stop at them. So there's a little bit less care involved in those.
So you got to obviously work with Matt and Gracie and, you know, a lot of the writers of the show and stuff like that. Did you get to work with the voice actors at all?
Yes, we were at every voiceover session.
Oh, brilliant.
Thankfully, they hired a director that directs them on a daily basis to direct them, because they they're very good at what they do and they're very opinionated in how they do it. But we were there to say, oh, we need a little bit more energy here. Oh, no, he's talking contextual here. Those were some of the best days, I think, on those games. And I think you end up laughing hysterically. And we got everything we wanted whenever we needed it. They can be very difficult because they're very in demand at the time, because the show was, you know, and like,
it was, you know, its peak, wasn't it? You know,
you know, you talk about Harry Shearer as a comedic genius, and like you say to him, like, oh, I have 10 lines in this 30-minute show. You say, okay, here's 720 lines. And you're like, you know, Hank Azaria was amazing because on Hit and Run, not to jump in, he did all the cinematics where his characters talk to each other in real time.
Oh, wow. Because he voices so many
things
with Hank. He voices like hundreds of the side characters, doesn't he?
Yeah,
so.
And this is not a lot. He looked at his script maybe three times, and I remember this dude, he had 812 lines. He was just so good. We did it at Howard Schwartz in New York, and he came in and he nailed it. And then, you know, right after that, we did Marge. But like, yeah, it was just like when you're seeing these characters in life acted out in front of you, and they're asking questions like, does this fit the timing and tone of what you're trying to do? It's just like, wait, you're asking me? Like, it's hard not to be a fan person, but you know, you're represented at Fox, and you had a little bit of backbone because Fox was putting on the show.
Yeah.
So we got, but it was always fun to deal with the cast because they're just so talented.
So what did you guys want to improve when you did Hit and Run, and were they more receptive to it once they'd realized that, you know, Road Rage had been a huge success?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Crazy Taxi comparisons when it hit the marketplace were absolutely valid. But I think it's one thing where Gracie and Matt were like, well, we're not going to do that again. We're not going to just be a Me Too thing. The big debate between the two was Radical came to us and said, we want to get out of the car and walk around.
Yeah.
And that was a big debate with Fox executives on the interactive side of like, what does that mean? You know, there are rules to that. You know, we did a demo of getting out of the car in front of Homer's house from Road Rage before we redid the engine. And like, we had kicking in there because they wanted a jump. The jump also had like a kick to it. And I remember like the first thing Matt did is he just kicked Marge as Homer. and he kicked her all the way down the street. And he looked at us like, we're never doing that in the game. This is not about abuse.
I'm fairly certain that's the first thing I did when I picked hit and run was just kick the first person I could find.
Exactly, right? We do a good job of trying. You cannot really hit the kids. The kids don't react.
Yeah.
There's no child abuse. But yeah, everybody, it's funny, poor Marge. Everybody tries to kick Marge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, getting out of the car was the big part of that. And then once everybody saw the potential of this, and then we started to build Springfield with more gameplay per square feet in mind, like the motel way off the distance with Lisa, and make the map. It's still kind of like, it's not an open world. It's kind of a track hidden by buildings and objects and hills. But Hit and Run 2 would have been what everybody wanted. But I felt like, you know, Matt told us, this is the game. We got it right. He still to this day refers to that as probably the best Simpsons game. And Gracie was very happy with it. So I think, like, at the end of the day, it sold very well. So, like, you know, the funny thing about that game is, like, you know, Fox Interactive was getting out of games. So they sold us to Vivendi, the entire group. So during the middle of that game, I think we were at Alpha. I left Fox on a Friday and showed up at Vivendi on a Monday and just continued to produce the game. It was very odd.
And that's interesting because when I was doing the research last night and I couldn't figure out what happened because you worked at Fox, then and suddenly it was Vivendi. And I was like, well, why did he do Road Rage with Fox and Hit and Run with them? So there we go. Now I know. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's they sold, like, I think Buffy went over.
Yeah,
Simpsons Buffy went over for a few times. The funny thing is like Simpsons generated hundreds of millions of dollars, Hit and Run did. And Fox presented Vivendi with, I think I can say this now because I'm so bitter about it still. Why we were doing pre-production on two follow-ups. We were doing pre-production on Hit and Run 2, which had all the air vehicles from the show.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we were doing a, remember Stormfront Studios who did the Lord of the Rings for EA?
Yeah.
Ray Gresko was the lead designer there. And, you know, he's moved on to, you know, Diablo fame and Blizzard fame. He designed for us a medieval Simpsons game based on the Lord of the Rings engine. And we were doing those two games. Then Fox says, okay, it's a 5-game deal for $25 million. And Vivendi said no.
Okay.
Oh, did much happen with that medieval one?
We have a, prototype video on VHS. I think it's in my garage. It's awesome. Like, we showed it to Matt, and he actually slapped the table, and he was clapping because it's a game that he always wanted because it's Simpsons, but it's not like what you think a cookie-cutter Simpsons game should be. In Stormfront, we had a huge dragon that Hank Azaria was voicing. Homer had, like, the Braveheart paint and the big club, and Bart was running around with an archery. Like, I think in the video, I think Flanders' head's on a pike.
You're gonna have to, you're gonna have to put that on YouTube. I mean, if you're allowed to.
And we had so Mr. Burns was a vampire that came alive off a stained glass window in a like, it was like awesome. And we have a bunch of concept art. I'll have to put the concept art to you guys. But like that game and Hit and Run 2 were like, this is it. We're kind of verging off into unique territory. We're following up a sequel with a hit game, and then Vivendi's like, $25 million. I know we made $600 million or whatever they made on Hit and Run, but like this 25.
Talking of something unique, there was a really odd feature, which I don't think I've seen on a game before, which was the kind of holiday theme. So your internal clock on the game would change, and then there'd be a Halloween screen
of
Homer in the living room, Christmas and Thanksgiving. Where did those ideas come from?
It came from a meeting we had with Radical, myself, and Matt Groening. I think Gracie was there as well. We were talking about like the internal clock on how the PlayStation 2 worked. And so like Matt or somebody asked, what could we do on holidays? And Radical is very open and very good about like pushing the limits of this kind of stuff. And I think they had already talked about doing holiday stuff. But then once Matt learned, like you could adjust the date on your PS2 to make it that holiday and play it, we put a lot of time and effort into that. Radical did a really good job. The Halloween one's great.
So with Hit and Run, you know, I was probably the prime age for it when it came out. I think I was about 14. So I was probably that perfect target audience, you know, somebody who at the time also adored Grand Theft Auto. And by the sounds of things, it doesn't sound like it was ever kind of like on paper that it was to be a GTA clone. It sounds like, you know, Radical, we want to get him out of the car, and it kind of developed from there. So my question was going to be, was the brief for it to be a GTA clone, or was that just kind of like, it just kind of happened over time and it just felt similar to that kind of game? And, you know, do you think it was as successful as it was because of games like GTA?
I think it was successful because of games like GTA, but I think it never really started out as that. We want to get out of the car. If you notice, there's a lot of collecting and platforming stuff of cars.
Yeah, it is a huge collector fun as well, yeah.
Right, but like once we got out of the problem is like you can't put the genie back in the bottle with creative people. Once you get out of the car, they're like, oh, we can do this, we can do this. Then we make a list, and you're like, well, this is never going to happen. So, but yeah, I think over time, people always associate it with GTA, and I can see why, because it's driving and getting out of the car. But it never really intended to be that. It intended to be a driving game that had platforming elements. And, you know, you go into like the Quickie Mart or the, you know, if you know that every doorbell and everything has a line of dialogue to it. Like you rattle the door by the Quickie Mart and there'll be a line from Moment, or I think it was Frozen in there.
Yeah, it's Jasper.
Jasper, right. So So the design team at Radical put so much effort into making sure that they touched almost every episode at that time. I give them a lot of credit because I would see things build that like, okay, we want this, this, and this, and they added like three more because they had time. But yeah, it was really just supposed to be driving and getting out and doing some collecting and platforming and some fan service of ringing a doorbell or going into the Quickie Mart. You know, we only did three or four interiors. But over time, I can see why, given the popularity explosion of open world games in GTA, I can see why people have the connection. And we sure weren't going to deny the connection. We're going to be like, oh, no. You know, it's nothing like the most popular game that's ever existed.
and it was like there was loads of hidden stuff as well. Like I remember the roof of the Quickie Mart and stuff.
Oh, yeah. behind their house. Inside the nuclear power plant, there's a bunch. The funny story about when we were at the end, and it was, you know, we always were about map holes right back then. And like there's a motel, and if you go there, you stop and you ring the doorbell, I think somebody said something like Principal Skinner, but like across the way with just Lisa, you could fall through the guardrail and fall through the map. And a QA person found it. And I, of course, given my background, I was pissed, but like I had to respect it. And we had I remember 10 people discussion, like, will Sony find this or Nintendo? And we're like, it has to be Lisa. It has to be this guardrail. It's the fourth one in or whatever. And we're like, you know what? I was like, let's just let it roll. We're fine. And Greg Goodrich, who was one of the executive producers, was helping with the game with it because it was such a large operation. We were like, we got it. And the very first bug report, the very first one, Lisa fell through the map. Like, I don't know how they found it. They found it day one.
Oh, wow. I remember I had a cheat disk for the GameCube, and it worked on hit and run, and you could go through the boundaries, but it was only as Bart and Lisa. You could only do it as the small characters, and it let you do all kind of crazy things, you know, flying through the sky and kind of a kind of semi-debug mode. So it's interesting that people found that.
Yeah, I was just so pissed. Yeah, but I really like the fact that if you remember, the car's damage went all the way down to like dragging the metal carcass of the car along the road. A lot of like, I'll give a lot of people, it's a team sport to make games. Lots of people do it. Obviously, there's a tip of the iceberg of creativity and then drive and then focus. But like Radical never stopped pushing the elements of what they could do as far as fan service. It was really impressive on that game. They went far and above and beyond.
Yeah,
absolutely. And as you know, that game became Scarface.
Oh, yeah. No, I was going to say you worked on Scarface next, didn't you? I haven't actually asked any questions about Scarface because I kind of moved to Ghostbusters next because you have worked on so many fantastic games. But I really wanted to ask, where did the decision for Apu to be the fifth player come from?
In Hit and Run?
Yeah, in Hit and Run, yeah. Not in Scarface, sorry.
But I think that, you know, that comes from... You know, we playability of the car, the locations that they went, we had a little bit of a sign, like a graph to it. But I think at the end of the day, Gracie and Matt make those decisions. What they feel best. So they helped us define which characters would be playable, which ones wouldn't. And you know, if we even had a graph that was off of that, you're not going to battle them on that because they kind of know what the fans are. Because the show is writing to those fans and there's uniqueness to the show. So I think, plus giving, you know, Tega's area's like great voiceover work because we used him a lot. I think the decision definitely came from a group between Fox, Gracie, because I had left Fox at the time, as I was Vendi, and Matt made that decision.
Fair enough. And do you know much about the Hit and Run remaster that's kind of been making headlines for the last kind of 3 or 4 years? And, you know, often... You know, especially in the UK, it's always winning polls for the next game, you know, that should be remastered and stuff like that.
I think a fan kind of redid it in like 4K. And
yeah, there's been loads of like, you know, fan remakes and stuff. But, you know, any sort of rumblings of an official remake? Have you ever heard of anything going on with it?
I have tried to remake that game six times. I've been called to try to remake that game six times. where it kind of nets out is I think we're great seeing Matt sit, from what I understand. I haven't heard this first person, but the feedback I've gotten through Fox was that they feel like this would be a money grab. And if they were going to do something, they'd like to do something original. They wouldn't. I think it's not a money grab. I think it's, there's an entire generation of parents that can tell their kids, I played this. This is my favorite game as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they see it more as a commercialization of a hit game. They'd rather do something original. And I think now that Disney owns it, from what I understand, the last two people that tried, they wanted so much money as a, in advance to do it. Because it's kind of like, it's weird because like Disney owns the assets, but Activision owns the code because of their verge with Vivendi.
Yeah.
So it's split and Radical's gone. And Radical was owned by Activision, which even reinforces their ownership of the engine, which became the prototype engine, right? After Scarface.
Yeah.
So it's just by, it's just split. Like we own the voice files and the assets and we own the code. So who gets to do it and who gets paid up in advance? So everybody wants a big advance. So I think it was like $10 to $20 million in advance between the two parties just to have the conversation, and Gracie wasn't too supportive of it. And so I think it needs to be remade. I was very happy when Obama got elected because, you know, I had that change.org website. Somebody posted a hit and run remake and it got like 9,000 likes. I'm like, why isn't this law? No, but it comes up a lot. Like my kids keep sending me stuff that they see on Facebook and said, this is my game as a child. And it's just like, it needs to be remade. It really, you're not going to get that kind of Simpsons game again. I just don't think the show's at a place to do that, and the talent's at a place to do that, and the energy is not quite around the franchise as it was.
The kind of, here in the UK, the kind of holy trinity of Simpsons games is the trilogy of, like, you know, PS2, the PS2 and GameCube ones of Road Rage, Hit and Run, and The Simpsons Game, you know, which came out around about the times of the film. And personally, I do think Hit and Run is the biggest and the best one of those three. And, you know, there's so many news outlets and stuff. We've covered it ourselves so many times on our news segment, you know, when there's murmurs and rumors of, you know, a Hit and Run remake. So it would be amazing, but I guess it makes sense, you know, that if Matt Groening doesn't want to do it, then it doesn't kind of happen.
Yeah. And the logistics of where's the code and who owns the assets, you got to put them together.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, the Simpsons game was interesting to me because I was like, when we lost the license and they got it, they made that game, I was like super overly bitter. Like, and I shouldn't have been, but I felt like that game was good, obviously, because it was pretty quality, but I felt like it was more of the Simpsons writers making an inside joke about their own games than it was a fan service outward to like, this is the Simpsons universe, enjoy it. I felt like they were making an inside joke about video games.
Yeah, the Simpsons game, the one after Hit and Run, it is that kind of satire, like even to a point where Comic Book Guy is the tutorial and he's like, oh, not another tutorial, like it breaks the third wall all the time, doesn't it? So like you say, it's the writers having fun with it.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt like it was a very quality game, but it's very like self-referential VA. It's a good game, but like I felt like it was, like to your point, it was a different tone.
Well, you mentioned Ghostbusters earlier, and you were executive producer and writer for that. What was it like? And you're a big fan of the series. Did that really help?
Yeah. So like there are like three or four games, like licensed games. If I could make anything, I would make those games. Obviously, Ghostbusters and Simpsons were on that list, right? So like, Back to the Future is the other one. I'll never, like, that's just too hard to create a game around Back to the Future. But like, it was funny because Hit Run did very well. And Vivendi's like, hey, you know, what do you want to do? Because like, you had success. It was very interesting. And like, so I had three games in pre-production. I had an original game with Storefront called Fairy Tale, which is like before Dark Disney. It was very Dark Disney, and Ray Kresko was the designer of that. And that got killed in the Activision merge. And we had an original game with Tim Burton in production, which was awesome, which was a dream of mine, right, to work with him at that time. So, which also got killed in the Activision merge. They had Ghostbusters, which like we went to Sony, and they're like, listen, it's a dormant license. It's pretty cheap. Our advance for that. And then I brought it. I remember bringing it to Greenlight with Pete Wannett, was also on it with me. We also did Scarface together, and he's a Riddick fame. But like, I remember marketing me like, well, there's no movie, like typical video game marketing, right? There's nothing we can get a lift from. Nobody cares about it. It's 25 years old. And then Bruce Hack, who was the CEO of Vivendi at the time, said, hey, I'll give you 2 weeks and a couple plane tickets. Because the way it worked is the actors have to say yes to it for the license to. Because they have part ownership of the license. I think it's not all Sony. So like,
yeah, because Dan Aykroyd wrote all of Ghostbusters. Like he invented Ghostbusters and stuff. So I guess he has a big share of it, I'm guessing.
Right. So we started with him. And I remember meeting at House of Blues and I was shaking because it's like, oh my God, it's Dan Aykroyd. And like Ghostbusters in 84 in the theater, like affected me. Like I saw that theater, I was like, what is this? And I could like, I was obsessed with it. Mm. And we walked him through and he's like, I think, you know, this will help. And maybe I'll do it. And what did Harold think? So we went to, the funny thing is we went to Harold second.
Yeah.
And we met with him on the set of The Office because he was directing The Office at the time.
All right.
Which is his own surreal moment, right? Mm. Like, hey, here's the office pit and let's talk about Ghostbusters. Pull out a laptop, right?
Yeah.
And we concentrate on the action and set pieces with Dan. And we concentrate on the narrative story and comedic elements with Harold because I felt like that was their wheelhouses. And Harold was like, I think I'm in because I feel like a generation of fans would really enjoy a continuation of the story. And like, then went back to Dan and Harold had a conference call with us and they were all in. I remember the panic on Sony because Dan and Harold, like, this is Ghostbusters 3. This is the continuation of the story. And Sony was like, we're not making a movie, but we're never gonna allow you to call it Ghostbusters 3. And now, of course, our marketing team's like, please call it Ghostbusters 3. And all the way through production, the code name was Ghostbusters 3. So it's kind of funny. But like,
yeah.
Then, you know, we went to Ernie and he was involved. Bill was the most difficult because Bill is Bill Murray, right? He's a legend and he's very busy and he's very like in his own world and he's a genius and he's just very difficult to get. We didn't think we were going to get him. We divided the plan to try to help. Like the whole goal for me was like, how do I get Bill to see the demo? Because we did a demo, which was very funny. It was also very, you know, the demo talked about the head of finance of Vivendi not funding it. And the, you know, because everybody in the Greenlight meeting had a line, all the executives were referenced in the demo. But like Bill, if you don't get Bill, like what's the point? And so my goal was like, how do I get Bill to see the game? Because if I ask him, he's going to say no. So what we did is we hired the mayor from the original movie. Then we fired the mayor from the original movie. And I came up with the idea of casting Bill's brother as the mayor, Brian Doyle Murray,
who's also
best friends with Harold, right? Their friendship is really with Harold. And so we flew Brian Doyle Murray into Vivendi and we showed him the demo. And he's like, you show the demo for every actor that plays a small bit. You want him to see the game before they see us. And I was like, of course. Like we want to shoot. And he says, he literally said at the end of the meeting, he's like, you want me to tell my brother that this is a good game. And we're like, yes.
Yeah.
And that was on a Monday afternoon. And I believe on Tuesday, Bill said yes. And I remember there was the only time I've seen a dog pile in a video game company is everybody was jumping in because nobody thought we were going to get him. And when he said yes, it was granted, it's very difficult after that to get in the studio. But him just saying yes galvanized that game into green light.
So what happens next? Like, did you have the script wrote? How involved were you in the script? Did Dan Aykroyd work on it at all? Because obviously, this game, for me, it's a legendary game. I adore Ghostbusters as well. And to this day, Dan Aykroyd is very, you know, this is canon, you know, it's part of Ghostbusters, you know, up until Afterlife came out, it was seen as you say, it was Ghostbusters 3. You know, people saw it as this is the continuation of Ghostbusters. So what happened next?
We hired a writer to work with Terminal Reality to write the story. And John Platton was one of the writers and they wrote a concept and it was really interesting and good. But Dan at the time was like, I want to use parts of this, but not all of it. So we didn't continue on with them to write the voiceover, but they helped kind of with the conceit. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we hired a couple writers too. Like I wrote with the creative director of Terminal Reality, the levels, right? And like the museum, if you know me, like I'm a big museum person. So that's why the museum comes to life. I was a big fan of the Ken Burns Civil War documentary. So that's why that scene's in that game. So we came up with like with Dan, like what areas would be cool to do in a game. And Dan's like, yes, I approve this. And Harold's like, I approve this. And then we kind of constructed through the game and we wrote placeholder dialogue for that. Then Harold and Dan took it and they freaked out because it's a side of Lord of the Rings. But like they're used to 120 page script and they're like, holy cow, we signed up for the X amount of money and this is how big it is. This is ridiculous. But they took it, they rewrote it, they worked with us, we went back and forth. So they really had their stamp on it. They really, really like laid into the lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
After the casino was decided. So we worked on the script for a while they were working on the vertical slice. We debated, there was a big discussion during that time period of can you drive the car or not? And we had a demo where the car was kind of on rails and we figured out that Terminal Reality just didn't have the maturity in their systems and engine to do a driving part of the game. So we did cut it.
Yeah.
The only thing that got cut too that we wanted is we had a Macy's Day Parade floats where they all come alive. which is oddly in the 2016 movie, but I don't want to say anything. But like, so yeah, we did that. And then, you know, it came down to like the voice recordings, and then and could we deliver the voice recordings? And the sad part is that Vivendi was trying to downplay the budget as we were trying to outplay them, but they wanted it to be a value title from the start. So it was a literal civil war with lots of casualties, and they're just a fight for this game. And we begged, borrowed, and stole to get where we were. And I think we hit a stride with the game development where we were going to make a 90 rated licensed game. And then the Activision Vivendi merged it, and they told the studio to stop working on it at alpha.
Oh gosh.
So while it was kind of in limbo when it was for sale, I couldn't work on it legally. And, you know, say 4 months goes by and Atari picks it up, so they don't get the code for another 2 months till the deal's done. You can't lose that momentum. Like you can't, teams can't just say, okay, pick up where we were, because we were firing in all cylinders. Dan was calling them, rooting them on. We were getting back and forth. We were playing the game, giving notes about timing and comedic stuff. And like we had start recording the dialogue. Bill's its own little disaster there. But like, but then you tell the developer between alpha and beta, say, take 6 months off, try to work on another project because you're not going to get this one. Oh, wait, no, go back and work on it. It just doesn't work. And so it's still rated, you know, I think around 80, but it could have been something special because we were on the path to deliver something really good. It just kind of fell apart because of the merge.
I don't think you should downplay it. It is really a special game. You know, obviously it got a remaster a couple of years ago, and it's a highly regarded game. I really enjoyed it, and a lot of people really enjoy the game. So, you know, my kind of last two questions about it was, what was the experience like working with the cast? Were you involved at all in the voice acting and the voice casting? Not the voice casting, you know what I'm trying to say. In the studio, essentially.
I directed each session.
Yeah.
Because, like, I helped write the script and with lots of people behind me giving me notes, right?
I bet that was insane.
I have the, like, my wife calls me fringe, where I'm close to famous but not famous because for whatever reason, and I don't know why, and I don't take any credit for it, I get along with like Matt Groening and Gracie and where other people haven't.
Yeah.
And I got along. So basically, Dan Aykroyd locked Sony out of it. And he says, I'm only going to deal with John. So I basically dealt with Harold and Dan on a weekly basis for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And it was like Harold Ramis defined my sense of humor, right? When we recorded him when he was still sick, it was in Chicago. Like the last thing he ever did was his pickup session for Ghostbusters. It's the last thing he ever did.
Yeah.
And like, it was really emotional just to get the game done because we were also super fans of it. But like the voice of sessions were awesome. Like the funny thing about Dan is like he would trigger on some lines that were just like tongue twisters, but he would not let you rewrite them. He was going to get it no matter what. And he was very like, the way Ghostbusters is written is like, it's Christmas morning and every scene, and like Harold and Dan's characters are the kids. Like, this is great. You know, the excitement for the present comes from Dan's character, and Harold's the more systematic. I got a science set, but the parent really is Bill Murray. If you notice in the way the humor does, he always talks down to them or tells them to be quiet or get, you know, they're weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of the way it was written. But like when they do the voiceovers, like it's amazing. And I remember recording Bill, and Bill didn't get to finish all his lines for any number of reasons, but like we were like 700 lines less than he should have recorded.
Oh, wow.
And Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd rewrote the script and came in and recorded their lines to cover off on those elements of the levels for free.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But this was like the third, like it really was the third movie. We took place in 91. Yeah. Yeah. We had a great sequel in mind. It just, again, like Atari was kind of out of business at that point.
And you know, just the story there about Dan and Harold Ramis, you know, coming in and rewriting it for free and doing those extra lines and stuff. It goes to show how passionate they were for it to be a good product and be seen as, you know, the true successor and stuff like that. It is a really, I guess, romantic kind of story, if you will. You know, it's really nice. And I'm really glad that it, you know, I know you feel slightly differently, but I'm really glad with the way it came out, and it was such a fantastic game.
Yeah, it's the only time they got back together to be those characters when those characters were still, you know, like Dan says, we're doing 91, you can make us all skinny again, right?
Yeah.
And like, they were actually the Ghostbusters that we knew, and they had this like, they have such a great chemistry between them back then. Even when we recorded the lines, and you know, Harold wasn't in the best of health, and like, it was just like the passion that he showed. Because like he is great because he was so dumbfounded that people have such passion for that. Like anything he's ever done, like he's like, you know it, you know every scene, you know every intent. And he was really like awestruck by that. And Dan is just a Ghostbusters fanatic and loves it. And he wants the universe to live. Like, you know, he's definitely with Ghost Corps brought it back. Mm. You know, Sony told us when we were at Alpha, like they were using this as a litmus test to see if they could sell toys and t-shirts. Like if anybody was interested, and that just spawned, you know, if you saw all the t-shirts and toys that hit the market after the game came out, I got no money from that. But like, but it was like, classic. It was like, you know, and they're great people. Like Dan called my wife at home when I sent him a note saying I'm out. The Vendy's done. Atari will take over. And he told her like, he'll be fine. Atari will hire him. Or I'll pay him to finish it, which is very nice for him to do. And I'm literally driving from LA to Orange County, you know, telling my wife, mm-hmm. like, that's it. My last day, he called and said, everything's going to be fine. And Harold called me once a month until like 2 or 3 months before his death, just to see how I was doing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And they're really great people. And they really cared that you cared, if that makes sense.
Like, yeah.
And they really wanted that to be a great game. They really wanted to be as authentic as possible, because at that time they thought this was it, right? We're not coming back.
Yeah.
It's of all the games I've done, you know, Simpsons Hit and Run was really hard to do, and it had a really great outcome, but and I'm really proud of it. But emotionally speaking and passion speaking, Ghostbusters was like, I lived that life for 3.5 years and fighting a lot of people who said, because there's no movie, we shouldn't be making this game at the Vendy trying to kill it on a monthly basis. Our head of production, I won't name his name, but like, just literally just like, this game won't work. We should be doing other things.
Say, I'm really glad it happened. And I'm really glad that, you know, yourself, Howard Ramis and Dan Aykroyd worked so hard on getting it done. You know, I'm truly thankful for that. It's a really fantastic
game.
That
game was officially killed 3 times at Vivendi. And the CEO brought it back every time. You know, other than the Tim Burton original game, which I think would have been like the demo was fantastic. I think like Ghostbusters would have been a cry. Those are the two games I want to see come to market, but at least Ghostbusters did, because I had such a fandom built in. I didn't have to work on a fandom.
Yeah.
It was just like, it was a labor of love for sure.
Brilliant
stuff. Well, John, it's been amazing talking about these fantastic projects that you've worked on. And I was just wondering, you're still in the industry nowadays. So have you been working on anything you can talk about?
I am currently an executive producer at NBC Universal, and I control DreamWorks and Jurassic.
So lots of stuff happening with Jurassic. That is in Jurassic World,
exciting
is it?
Exciting stuff coming up, yeah.
Yeah, do a lot of great integrations. Obviously, the Frontier game, you know, Evolution and Evolution 2 is great.
Yeah.
The part builder. A lot of great partners, but I will say there's stuff coming in the future that you guys will love.
Oh.
But yeah, it's been fun. You know, again, like I get to work with some great people, you know, Amblin and Colin Trevorrow, all those guys are like we talked about, Colin Trevorrow is deeply involved with these games. He gives his input, he wants to see him, he wants to be heard. And he's made these games great by like I said, not just approving assets, but like, let me help you make the best game possible. Let me clear the path for you. Let me give you my creative feedback. It's been invaluable.
Thanks for
coming on. I think me and Joe have had a really, really interesting interview.
This has been fantastic. I could have gone for another hour about Ghostbusters, and you know, and it was the tip of the iceberg. I know we probably only covered about a quarter of the games that you've worked on there, but. You know, sometimes we just try to get that narrative and kind of get some of the biggest games, you know, that you worked on, like kind of discussed and stuff. But no, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for coming on, John.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Like anytime anybody like likes a game that you make that stands the test of time, I'll talk about it all day long. Like especially the Ghostbusters, we could have a whole episode on the actual details of making Ghostbusters, because it needs to be a reality show.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, our other presenter, Dan, is an absolutely huge Ghostbusters fan. So maybe that's a Ghostbusters special if you're up for it in the future.
Absolutely. I bet you could probably get Dan in there too.
Yeah,
his dog's even called Winston.
No, absolutely.
He's a big fan of the game and what it did for him. And he's doing a phenomenal job at Ghost Corps. But I love the last movie. Like, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, same.
It was really good. It brought it back, and it kind of like opened up old emotional wounds that you have when you saw the first in the theater. It was really well done.
Awesome stuff. Yeah,
that would be amazing.
Well, fingers crossed.
Was I supposed to have a cameo in that by Harold? Yes, I was. But did
really?
Get a cameo in that? No, I did not.
Oh. That's
I kept waiting by the staring at the phone. No, no call.
Oh, bless you. Well, fingers crossed for a Ghostbusters special with yourself and Dan Aykroyd on the Retro Hour one day.
Absolutely.
That would be insane. So, but thank you so much for coming on, John. We've really enjoyed this.
Great. I had a great time. Thank you very much.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.